You know, looking at one's own experience and realizing that you don't wake up until you're ready to wake up, it helps you to relax about the people around you that you would like to be different than they are. It's just always important to remember that. And the whole first chapter that we read tonight, Getting My Sea Legs, let me just make sure that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. He's just talking about the empathy, the compassion, the understanding of human nature, all the things that he learned from the difficulties he faced. And that really is the test that all of us face in our lives. What do we do with the experiences that we have? The experiences can't be helped, but it's entirely a question of how we take it. And we just wake up when we're ready and not before. Yeah. It does help if we approach life eagerly, though. A great many trials and tests can be mitigated if you realize, well, there's twofold. If one is in the habit of looking at life as something to see how little I can get away with, then all tests seem huge. If one is in the habit of approaching life with how much can I give, then the flow of energy is in motion. So even when karma hits, it doesn't seem overwhelming because it's not like you're trying to start from a dead stop to respond to something. You're already an object in motion. And on another level, if you're already strongly engaged in learning everything you can learn, it's not necessary for God to give you such tough tests, in a sense. I mean, that's not exactly true, because many difficult things happen to good people. But there's just a different reality to it. So it's a very important. I mean, the reason Swamiji was able to weather what he weathered was because he had such a deep connection with God and Guru and such a strongly in place habit of meditation and attunement and acceptance of God's will. So there was a whole context in which he could put what had happened to him. If he'd been any less grounded in his relationship with Master especially, then Tara would have been able to derail him because that was her intention. So it's a very instructive lesson. That's why Master will says things like group meditation. He puts a tremendous importance on group meditation. Tremendous is perhaps overstating it, but he does say that group meditation is an extremely helpful practice for devotees because he said group meditation helps build a fortress of divine power which acts as your security in times of trial. And it's also, if you're in the habit of group meditation, it helps maintain your meditation when difficulties come, and it gives you a place to go where there's strength. Few of us have the kind of strength that Swamiji has to be able to stand entirely on our own in uncongenial circumstances and still hold on. So it's getting the right habits in motion really serve us well in the long run. It's very important. Any other questions or comments? Let me get my little story together here. It's very interesting, especially those of us who've been part of Ananda for a long time, but I think everybody would find it interesting, what Swamiji considers the story of Ananda and how. You know, you find when you get to the end of the book, he tells us so little about what he actually did to make Ananda happen. And he himself says the story of a place called Ananda ends in 1970, which is hardly the story of Ananda. But the real story of Ananda is these attitudes and this consciousness that he brought to the project and in transferred to the individuals involved. I was thinking a lot about this right recently because of what I've been doing, but in the very early years of Ananda, which I'm not sure whether he really says this in this book or not, I don't recall, so I'll talk about it anyway. If he does, I'm jumping the gun for later chapters. But in the early years of Ananda, and for many, many, many years, the beginning it was more dramatic, but it actually remained so for a long time, because as things begin, so they continue. Swamiji's way of taking leadership has always been so understated. He's never allowed there to be any accoutrements of leadership or special ceremonies because he's the leader. In more recent years, people have essentially spontaneously taken to standing up when he comes into a room. But that was a very recent development, and he did his best to fight against it, and then he finally just accepted that that was what people were going to do. But such things were completely unknown for the first 25 years of Ananda. I mean, he would come into a room, and he would just be coming into a room, and he would be whatever he was going to be, and he always had such a natural manner to him. I don't know if it's in this book or not, but he's always fond of telling this story where he was at some function. It might have been in San Francisco, maybe somewhere else, where he was speaking to this woman afterwards, and they were discussing whatever they were talking about, and she introduced herself finally, and then he introduced himself as Swami Kriyananda. And she said, "Oh, but you're famous." And then he said, "What do you mean, but?" He said, well, you don't seem famous. And then he laughed, and then she made it worse by saying, "Well, I mean, people who are famous usually seem important." And he thought that was a great compliment. And what, of course, she meant was that people who are famous usually seem self-important, because they take themselves seriously. They think they're somebody special, because after all, everybody else thinks they're somebody special. And Swamiji has exuded so little of that vibration. Plus, it's a quality I noticed in him when he was last actually in Palo Alto and he stood up to speak here in this church. And I was conscious, as I am these days, of how much anticipation there is for his visits now, because they're so rare. And there's such a sort of expectation that he's a great man, and therefore I should perceive him as a great man. And it sort of, unfortunately, it warps the experience a little bit. It's hard for people to just take it straight for what it is, because there's all that having been told, which is, you know, the negative side of what's happened to him. But I observed when he was speaking that almost every public speaker or performer uses emotion and personality at least a little bit to draw people to them. Do you know what I mean? That just sort of they create something a little bit with their ego that gives people a little bit to grab onto. And Swamiji, the quality of his consciousness can and often is completely missed by people, because it's so pure that you almost don't see what's there unless you have that receptivity yourself. And in the early years of Ananda, it was so much more even that way, that you just had to be listening. You had to pay attention sort of day after day to what was manifested through his energy and the consistency of his friendship and the consistency of his advice and the consistency of his teaching and the just the vibration that he put out. Because otherwise, there was no reason for you to think that he was doing anything special or even doing anything at all. So where was I coming with that? Just let me try to remember, because I had a different point. What I was saying, but I can't remember now why, was that at the beginning there was a many, many people who opposed him. Ananda sort of started in this odd sort of way, which was Swamiji was focused on one aspect of it, which is he built the retreat, and then right in those early years he moved over to where he lives now, which is Ayodhya, and he took a group of monks and nuns and built Ayodhya. But the farm was purchased, the property that people think of as the community, nobody calls it the farm anymore, but the village, was purchased because he had to purchase it, because there was a controversy with the people with whom he bought the retreat property, and they didn't want him to develop anymore, and people were coming and he couldn't build anymore. Plus, it became evident as soon as the first families came, and this little child named Sisi showed up, that you couldn't have a meditation retreat in Sisi on the same 72 acres. She was a wonderful child, but she just was a very loud and very exuberant and very willful child, and 72 acres just wasn't big enough for people to meditate and for her to have a life. I mean, and it was indicative of the fact that we just really couldn't have families and children in that environment. The two forces coincided, and coincided with this opportunity for Swami to buy this property that was perfect, which is the property that is now what people consider the village. But he wasn't, in a sense, ready to buy it. God pushed the timing. And so the property was purchased, and I don't know whether he asked Jyotish to move down there or exactly how it happened, but Jyotish went to live there. And then it just kind of had to grow on its own. And it was the 60s, and even though there was no advertising, somehow the word went out that there was this property was there, and a new commune was starting. It's like went through the grapevine. And as Jyotish describes, you know, 5 or 6 cars a day would just pull up. And it was just that era. People were driving around in buses and vans and things like that, and just out looking for adventure. And they just showed up because there was this land, and, you know, we were going to be there. So this, all these people just came, and you can't have a community without people. It's sort of like that's what a community is. And there were people needed to work the gardens and do the businesses. And so it just sort of, we joked about it, that the admission requirement was if you said you didn't take drugs and you could chant Om. First we asked people if they could chant Om 3 times, but then we lowered our standards. They just had to chant it once. That was enough. And you could be there. And people were interested in spiritual things. That's why they were there. But their ideas were widely different. And Swamiji was very, very incidental to that process. And there was just like 2 Anandas building. There was this whole group, mostly living at the retreat, mostly living at Ayodhya, who were really with him. And even among them, there was a wide spectrum of what that meant. There were people who were just devoted and hung on every word, and there were others who followed Master and were interested in what Swami said, but at least they were with Swami. They would come to his classes. I mean, he would give classes and services, and that whole group of people at the farm almost never came, because he was just like one of the people who was there. And in fact, if anything, they were a little bit against him, because their idea of spiritual community did not include, any one person being too influential. After all, we're all the same divine spirit, so why would this one person, you know, it was all very fuzzy thinking. You know, even the merest child can be as wise as the greatest sage. Why should we listen to him? Just we might as well listen, let the baby speak, you know, sort of energy. And so it just sort of went on like that for a very long time, and he had quite a job on his hands to kind of keep it together and know when to push and when to let it run. And Swamiji's way was always to work with positive energy. He never confronted negative energy. That's not entirely true, but he didn't start there. His idea, just as he wrote, and he writes that in the part about Delhi. You know, Calcutta was such a mess. His idea was to go to Delhi, get positive energy going, and then bring it back. You can't do anything with negative energy unless you have positive energy to counter it. So when he saw that energy building up at the farm as it was, he just concentrated on building strength where there was strength, because he knew when he had sufficient magnetism on this side, that would be the time to turn and sort of deal with that energy, which was always just no-saying. It wasn't that they were bad people. They were very good people, many of them. I often say if you had to be on a raft, you know, in the middle of the ocean, those are the kinds of people you'd probably want with you. They were good people. They just weren't on the same wavelength. They were just doing something else. And so he had to really steer a very difficult course through all of that against enormous opposition. It's like the power that started with SRF has never stopped even today. You know, there's just this sort of force that's always trying to say, what do you know? Who are you? Why are you trying to tell us what to do? Just that kind of energy. And all of this period that he describes just in this very first chapter after he was kicked out of SRF, it's such a picture to think about it. I have a picture in my mind of his parents' house, so I know exactly where he went to stay. His parents lived in Atherton. They had a home at a sort of a cul-de-sac. His father had been very successful in Esso. He was an executive, and he was in charge of work in different countries, and he was a shrewd man. He'd invested in the stock market, so they were very comfortable. And they had this very nice home in Atherton. And his mother was extremely dear. His father was always a little bit critical. You know, he's very kind to his father. But he says things like, well, my father thought I was a grown man and old enough to be earning my own way, which was not a bad way for a father to think. His father might have also taken a different approach because he had the resources to help him, but he didn't. He just didn't think it was appropriate. And he also as Swami describes in there, his father was, he had three sons, and he was just so scrupulously fair. He absolutely refused to give almost so much as a nickel to one boy unless he gave it to all three. And the fact that Swamiji might have had a special need or a special reality just would not carry water with Ray. He was very, very exact in this way. His mother was just much more heartfelt in her nature. And Swami's relationship to his family was really through his mother. He, in fact, in discussions with... Well, I asked him questions at different times, and others have too, just trying to sort out family relationships. And he just made the comment that oftentimes in a family, you'll come for one member of the family. And then everybody else may be the karma of the others. I mean, like his mother had karma with everyone else, but Swami's intersection with the family was through his mother. That doesn't mean that there was nothing with everyone else, but it was because of her. He was following her. And then she brought with her the rest of the package. It's a very sort of comforting thing to hear because we do have that actual reality. And his father never really approved of the choice he made. So Swami doesn't, because he's not, that's not really the, it's too personal an aspect of the story and it doesn't relate to the story of Ananda. But here he was, at 22 years old, he dropped out of college already. He was going to be a playwright. He decided not to be a playwright. Instead, he got this, from his parents' point of view, insane idea to go to California and join this group of people. And he went out there. So he's following this nutty way of life, and now he's gone to India. And his parents were very international. He worked overseas most of his career, except when World War II compelled him to be in the United States. So it wasn't that they were in any way provincial. But still, it was an odd choice, especially as far as his father was concerned. So when it blew up in his face, and Swamiji had to just go home and be a grown man, utterly penniless, back in the bedroom of his parents' house, he's 36 years old at this point. And he's thrown everything he had into this reality that has failed now. Now what does he do? And so he just describes it a little poignantly. There I was living in my parents' house trying my best to serve them and feel that I was serving God. But can you just imagine it? It's important to understand that, and just in one simple sense, which is that everything that you see around you now, Swami manifested from nothing. I mean, he had nothing. He was penniless, friendless, and hopeless in a sense. I mean, all he had was himself and his devotion to Master and Master's voice ringing in his ears, "You have a great work to do." Just think how, when Swami himself, because he's not inclined at all to justify himself, but when he came under attack, I often reference the attacks that came to Swamiji, partly because this book was written in response to those attacks. He just thought he needed to tell his side of the story objectively. But he, when people criticized him, for being imperfect in his vows of celibacy, or that's the main thing, that was the only thing that had any factualness at all. Everything else was totally trumped up, that he was abusive and power hungry, it was just a joke, a miserable, horrible joke, but a joke nonetheless. But every once in a while he would say, "I would like to see any of them do what I have done. Face what I have faced and come through." He said, "Everybody who leaves the monastery," he said, "is married within a month." He said, "I could have gone that way, but I didn't want to. Master had made me a monk and I was going to stay a monk. He only gave it up under completely different circumstances much later, for a period of time because he felt that it was what Master wanted him to do. But he said, even if I had to struggle," he said, "it was what I was going to do. I was going to hold to it." How strange it is, isn't it, that instead of admiring that, we denigrate it? I mean, the culture is so sick, just so profoundly sick, and it's very important for at least some of us to just stand absolutely strong against it. I had a very strong revelation. I gave a sermon on this in the middle of the Bertolucci trial. I actually got a standing ovation. It's the only time I've ever gotten a standing ovation from a sermon. And because I had been thinking through what was going on in that case. This is all relevant to Swami's story, and I'll tie it back in a few moments. What happened in the Bertolucci case was, you know, this man who was a wonderful friend of ours, Danny Levin, was in a marriage where he wasn't happy. He met Anne-Marie Bertolucci. He felt this tremendous karmic connection with her and this enormous attraction. She the word that I use for her privately is that she was a professional, which is an extremely unkind word, because Danny was an innocent and she was not. She managed to draw him into an affair. Danny made the decision, and after he made that decision, Swami supported him that he should stay with his wife. Swami didn't tell him to stay with his wife, but when Danny made the decision to stay with his wife, Swami supported him. So there's an important distinction. And then when Anne-Marie didn't want to cooperate with that, Swami told her that he simply could not allow her to just sit at the village and destroy Danny's marriage. She would have to go live somewhere else at Ananda. And Swami said himself, when he made that decision, he knew that there would be enormous consequences to that decision, but it was the right decision. He was just going to make it. Where there is Dharma, there is victory. So when everything else came to pieces and the whole story came out, even when people knew that Danny had gotten himself in trouble in this way, Danny had turned his life back around and was trying to go in the right direction. And it was an infatuation. People who were more objective could see who she was, but when somebody's infatuated, you can't tell them. But people supported Danny instead of turning and condemning him. And which is, you know, how dare you behave like this? You're a minister in the community. You shouldn't have done this, like this kind of energy. And ultimately, when we're sitting in the courtroom, we're being excoriated because we didn't do that to Danny. I mean, that's really how it came down. You know, the way they twist things, it's like, don't you have any standards? You should have protected. You should have done this. How dare you allow this to go on? How could you have, you know, and it's like, you, because a courtroom is such an unnatural setting, you can't defend yourself against that. But I realized that what we were being excoriated for was the fact that we stood by our friend. We wanted to help him recover from a case of poor judgment. We wanted to have him know that no matter what happened, we were still family. We wanted to support his wife and his child in this. I mean, that was what was really, really came back on us. Isn't that strange? And I said I would rather go down in flames than give up that way of being. You know, if we'd kicked Danny out and humiliated him publicly, that would have been considered the right thing. Not really, because people were just playing. But isn't it strange? But Swamiji, it was just natural to us. I mean, because that's how Swamiji has always related to all of us. It was just so bizarre to have him be portrayed as this mean, judgmental, abusive person. Every person who's part of Ananda, whether you know Swami directly or not, because everything that you receive from Ananda is what Swami has set in motion. I mean, there's one element, which is kindness and a forgiving attitude, which is everyone makes mistakes. If we don't have a chance after we've made a mistake, well, Swamiji put it in a slightly different way. He said, if I expected my friends to be perfect, I would be a very lonely man. You know? And if God expected us to be perfect, he wouldn't have very many devotees. And so Swamiji, lying in the bedroom of his parents' house, staring at the ceiling and wishing to die, just ran through all of these different thoughts in his mind. You know, what does a devotee do in a moment like this? And he describes, you know, there were the three choices, I think, as he put it. You can learn from it. You can become angry. You can go for revenge. What would be the point? And he just made this profound and conscious decision with all his willpower that they are my friends, and if I'm not their friend anymore, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to extend friendship to them. And he made the decision that he would do the right thing. Sometimes I joke with people, sometimes you find yourself in circumstances where you can't affect what's going on around you. The world won't cooperate, or you owe too much money to ever be able to earn enough, or whatever it might be. And I always say, just do your dharma. Do the right thing in a vacuum. Like, don't think about the consequences. Don't think about the world beyond you. Don't think too rationally and reasonably. Just take your little piece of consciousness and direct it in the right way, because that's really all that God asks of you. If still you fail miserably, what difference does it make? And so Swamiji had that question, in, you know, on a level that few of us will ever be asked to answer it. But just what is the right thing to do? And even as he describes it, when his parents' friends would say, why aren't you living in the monastery anymore? Because, of course, all his parents' friends knew, because he was the oldest son and he'd been living in the monastery for 14 years and they all knew where he was. He said, it would have been easy for me to lie. He said, well, they threw me out. And then he didn't say any more. He said, I didn't want to rationalize what had happened to me, because I wanted to be completely open and to be able to hear it, whatever might be true. Just think, it's so... when you really project yourself all the way into the circumstances of his life and hear the decisions he made and how he decided to handle what happened to him, it's just such an extraordinary example for all of us in these little... And he's so generous, too. He says, I'm not going to say that I suffered more than other people suffered. You know, very difficult things happen to everyone. My case wasn't worse. He just happens to be telling his own story. But, you know, many terrible tragedies happen to people. And that inclination to justify yourself. In Hope for a Better World, there was that phrase that I liked too much, where it talked about how it was difficult to change habits because our habits send deep roots into the subconscious, winding through subterranean caverns of ancient self-justifications, unresolved disappointments and hurts. But that particular phrase, ancient self-justifications, is the one that strikes me, because Swamiji was talking about that. Because how will you ever know what's true if you're so busy explaining what's true? He wanted to just to be able to hear it and to just go forward with a loving attitude no matter what. I mean, he has a few things in here, maybe it comes later, where he talks about Tara used to call him up and just excoriate him for long periods of time. Now, the most obvious thing in the world was to hang up the telephone. And he deals with it in just a simple way. It was a rudeness of which I was not capable. And you hear that and you think, it's just you don't actually know what to do. You don't know whether he's a fool or a rishi when you hear that. Is this man a saint, or is he just like, does he not function? I mean, hang up the phone. But hanging up the phone is a gesture of rejecting. You know, it's like, I don't need to hear this anymore. I don't want to hear this anymore. And Swamiji made the inward decision that he was not going to reject this test. He was not going to try to protect himself from it. Whatever was going to come, he was just going to let it come. This belonged to him. Now, just imagine, again, having that much courage. How could you? That's interesting, that particular quality of Swamiji's. It came out also in the middle of the Bertolucci trial, because these two girls, especially this girl named Kamala and her obedient sidekick, imposed themselves upon Swamiji, and that is actually the word, because I was there at the time, I knew. People were very respectful of Swamiji's privacy, and you just didn't go to his house unless you had a reason to go. But not Kamala. She would just come in whenever she wanted to come into his house. And she would go downstairs into his room, she would go down to his bedroom, and she actually literally would go into his bed. And when he was in seclusion, he came down to see her. She just imposed himself on her. And wait, she just imposed herself on him. I have to say the grammar right. And the obvious thing is, well, why didn't you kick her out? He said, well, that would have been rude. And he said, I know, that sounds ridiculous, unless you know him. And then he said, now I would have done it. Meaning, if I had known how she would betray me, now I would have done it. I would have been rude to her. But there was another reason for it, which is just extremely important, which is just his awareness of how his energy impacts people. And, you know, to be unkind to someone, to make them feel rejected, he recognizes that has a lot of force. And he didn't want to be rude to her. But he didn't want to be rude to Tara either. He didn't want to be rude to anything that life forced upon him. And think how casually the rest of us just accept and reject at will all the time. We're always just, you know, asserting ourselves. It's a tricky business, and I always make a caveat, you know, you have to be psychologically healthy to be a good devotee. You can't just behave a certain way out of cowardice. Swamiji has all the courage in the world to do anything, so he can make a conscious decision. He's free. His actions are freedom. They're not based on fear, which is a difference. But then he just lay on that bed and he just thought and he thought day after day, what am I supposed to do? And he had this dilemma in his mind too. See, nothing is assumed. He just doesn't assume, I know what Master wants. I know what I should be doing. It was, what do you want, Master, with just this total receptivity. And even when Dr. Chaudhary and Bina met him, Haridas Chaudhary and Bina, and tried so hard to draw him in, his first response was, I can't do this. Because everybody that he'd been listening to his whole life had told him that he shouldn't. And also, it was just like this excess of care, of caution now. You know, I'm on my own completely. You have to see, he was completely on his own. And so he was going to have to figure out every move himself, what is really going to be the right thing to do here. And he had to be very, very careful because he had no safety net anymore. He didn't have gurubais or monks or spiritual superiors, and he really hasn't since for the rest of his life. He's never had peers. He's lived his entire life without peers. He's had very devoted friends. I mean, more than just students, but true friends, very devoted friends, but not peers. He's never had peers. Ever since he was 36 years old, he lost them all. All his friends have just repudiated him. Just unthinkable, isn't it? But the balance point is now that there's thousands of people around the world who would do anything for him. You know, karma comes to zero. All the opposite have a down. Every wave on the ocean that goes up has a wave that goes down. And finally, what difference does it make? He's excoriated on one hand and then adored on the other. And it, ultimately, what does it matter? So he developed these principles. He could see what SRF had done wrong in terms of not understanding the importance of people. People are more important than things. He says that over and over again. It keeps reappearing. People are more important than things. People are more important even than the rules that are made to guide the people. He's just like, and that's why I recall, Ananda's been extremely good at this. What Swamiji was doing in those early years, that's what I was starting to say when I was talking about the two groups. The group that Swamiji trained, he trained in right consciousness and right attitude. And I know in this book he says, the other group was building the community by figuring out how the land would be used and trying to get social organizations and, you know, those all sorts of things. And Swami sort of felt, let them do whatever they want because that really won't make any difference. What is really going to build Ananda is the right consciousness that is being cultivated in this group of people. And that right consciousness was all exactly the right things that he's puts here, the exact opposites, the understanding what is the true purpose of what we're doing. The organization is not an end in itself. It's just a collective form through which we can project energy. What is the purpose of Ananda itself is to help the individual spiritually. And there really is no reality. You know, and the absolute, absolute necessity of putting Dharma first. I mean, to such an extent that I don't think there's hardly anyone in Ananda who could not put Dharma first. You just know so deeply from all the years of training that Swami put into us that it just won't work. It's not tempting because it won't work, among other things. You know that as soon as you veer off the path of Dharma, and all the time we have this beautiful example of SRF to show us what happens if we don't behave that way. They've been just so much our friends. That's why the whole story of SRF is the story of Ananda. But because they have exemplified and imposed upon Swami everything that we never want to impose upon anyone else. And of course, individuals lose their center from time to time and do things that we wish we didn't do. But that's quite different than losing track of the basic principles. I used to joke in the early years of Ananda, which was such an idyllic period. I mean, physically it was so tough, but it never felt tough at all. It was just idyllic. But people were so just honest and good, and we lived way out in the woods. You literally, you could leave thousands of dollars just sitting out on a table, and no one would touch it. You couldn't leave a plate of cookies, though. They would always, everybody would just take one. It was truly like ancient India. A friend of mine, a Swamiji, an acquaintance, who's a wandering sadhu, had been a wandering sadhu in India. He used to wander around and he used to try to find places where television hadn't yet reached. It became more and more difficult as time went on. I mean, I first met him some 20 years ago. And he talked about it. He said the quality of consciousness in those villages in India was, he said, you know, you could lose a valuable diamond ring and drop it on the road. He said you could come back weeks later and it'd still just be sitting there. No one would touch it because it wasn't theirs. They would just leave it there. He said once television reached the village, though, all of that would go away because it just completely corrupted the moral system that was in place. But when he said that, I said, oh, that was Ananda was always like that. Now there's a lot more coming and going of people who aren't so well involved. I was talking about when it was very isolated at the retreat and there was just nobody near us who wasn't trained in these attitudes. And Swamiji's comment also, which he made more recently, was if the consciousness is... He was talking about people's passion for systems and for organizing things in certain ways, and there was this whole movement to make some certain organizational changes within Ananda, and Swami was resisting them. It's just too complicated a system. We don't need a system like that. He said, if the consciousness is right, any system will work. And if the consciousness is wrong, no system will work. So there's just no point. You just have to cultivate it from the right end. And that was, again, what he was beginning to understand. You know, just lying there at his parents' house trying to figure out what he was going to do. And then the Chaudhuries got a hold of him. And that it was a friendship that lasted for a long time. Haridas, Dr. Chaudhury, died quite a number of years ago, 2025 maybe. Bina's still alive. She's elderly, and I talked to her not too long ago, and she just talked about Swami was like a son to them, in his devotion to India and the way they treated him and he treated her. And he was such a light. Oh, and I know I was going to tell you because you asked this. There's an interesting little sidelight to this. Bina told me this story more recently, that when Haridas came from India, he was a disciple of Sri Aurobindo. And he lived in India. I asked Bina, I said, how did you all end up over here? Because he came quite early. And that enterprise, the Cultural Integration Fellowship or the American Institute of Asian Studies, they're kind of like companion organizations. They're still going strong. I think you can get PhDs from, they run like a college now. I think Dr. Chaudhry had been a professor of some sort. And he was a disciple of Aurobindo. And she told me exactly, but I think it was, he was just there in India, and then some disciple of Aurobindo or Aurobindo himself said, they need someone in San Francisco, you should go. And just sort of like out of nowhere, he just picked up and moved to America, and he lived the rest of his life here. And, you know, Bina, his dutiful wife, had to come also. It was harder on her at the beginning, but she adjusted. So he was here in San Francisco, and Master heard that, because I guess they're Bengalis, the Chaudhuries, and so is Master. The Master's here. This is like, what would this be? Well, Swamiji was there in the early 60s, so this might have been the 40s or the 50s. When this was happening, maybe in the 50s. Well, Master died in 52, so it couldn't have been. It was right around the end of the 40s, maybe. And Master heard that another Bengali had come to America representing Sri Aurobindo, and Master sent an invitation to him. Bina wasn't yet in America. And Master sent an invitation and said, you know, if you can come to Southern California, I would love to have you here. So he went down, and Master hosted him, and Bina was telling me, so she couldn't tell me much more than that, except that Master was there and how gracious he was. And she also just talked about how extremely helpful Master was. Here he was setting up another ashram. He wasn't a follower, but Master gave him advice about working with Americans and, you know, just, you know, the kind of practical things that Master knew because he had been there longer and Haridas was new to the country, and just kind of helping them out. And isn't it interesting that then he played such an important role. And Dr. Chaudhary himself said, you know, Master was telling me, I could feel your guru telling me not to take no for an answer, but I had to get you to do this. Who knows what the Leela was there, whether Master implanted in him at that time the power to be able to play such a key role in Swami's life. Perhaps something else would have happened, but really if it hadn't been for Dr. Chaudhary, and even at that critical moment when Swamiji was ready to go off into seclusion, and he was heading off to Mexico, and Dr. Chaudhary had his heart attack, and then he just couldn't do it. And by the time that year was finished, he was really settled in to San Francisco, and he spent that whole year working on this book. And by that point, the energy had turned. And so the die was cast, and Swamiji could see the direction he was going. The other thing that, of course, is in here, and Swamiji gives us like the cliff notes on Crises in Modern Thought, Out of the Labyrinth, it's presently called. That book it's been sort of a bittersweet joke for Swamiji. By now, he's rewritten it three times, and it's Out of the Labyrinth, but it was Crises in Modern Thought for many years of Ananda. And from time to time, Swamiji would just ask people who were close, people who were new, if they had read that book. And of course, almost no one had read the book, because most devotees did not find it interesting. And it was just not well known. If you had read Crises in Modern Thought, it was like the way into Swamiji's heart. It was just made him so happy to know that somebody had read it, because he worked 16 years on that book, and he spent such a long time writing that book. 16 years. Where did I get that number? No, yeah, he didn't. He finished it in 1972, so no, he spent 10 years on it. But he rewrote it and rewrote it. He wrote it, you know, he spent 40 years on it by the time he finally finished it. But Terry McGilloway made an interesting comment at a panel we were having about on Swami's birthday this last time up at Ananda Village. Terry's one of the colony leaders in Seattle, a very insightful man. And he said that everything that Swamiji's done has really been based on Crises in Modern Thought. And Swami himself concurred, and I was thinking about that while I was reading through here, because, see, here's what happened. Swamiji's in SRF. He goes in and he's a monk. Now, you're a monk living with other monks. You have a very consistent reality. It's the great danger of that kind of life, and that's really what has sunk Dhyamata to a large extent, is the complete lack of objective input. And it's so easy in that environment to just lose touch, and then the greater temptation is to become somewhat disdainful of ordinary people's realities. That certainly was what Tara fell into, and that really has been a lot of the bane of SRF, is that they just lost touch with what normal people think. And Swamiji was more or less in that mode. I mean, he was even in India, and he had hoped to make his life in India. He wasn't even going to deal with the West at all. He's never had that much of an affinity for America. He didn't grow up here, and he didn't like it much when he was forced to come here, and even his disdain for America, as you recall, caused him not to buy the autobiography when he first saw it, because it was dedicated to an American saint, and that was enough for him to put it back on the shelf. How could there be a saint in America? I mean, it just gives you a clue about how Swami thinks. And he talked about when he was going to have to leave India. I don't know whether it was the trip when he came back in the middle of his time in India, or when it was when he came back at the end. But he was going to have to come back, and he just could hardly bear the thought of coming back to this culture. And then he said an American girl from California came to see him, or he met her, and she personified everything that was good about Americans: the innocence, the enthusiasm, the generosity of spirit, the openness of accepting everyone. And he felt like it was God's gift saying to him that there are devotees everywhere, it's okay. But so Swamiji describes, you know, he describes Master sort of like giving him a clue before the blow fell, which was implanting him in him this thought: I could write a book. I could write a book about this subject, which is a very important subject. And probably the thought without ego had come to Swami: who else could write a book like this? Because there was nobody else in SRF who could write on the level that he could, and There was just a handful of disciples of Master. Master himself was gone. He wasn't going to write it. And Swamiji could see this all-pervasive sickness that had set in that is still rampant, you know, just even worse now. And the thought came to him, well, I could answer this. I have something to say. But, you know, the back of his mind was, how will I ever have the time and who would ever publish it? And then he describes, and he spends a lot of time really telling us how very difficult it was for him to pay enough attention to those ridiculous arguments to really be able to answer them in a way that didn't just mock them. It's very hard to do, to move out of your own reality sufficiently to really feel somebody else's reality. And the reason that I say everything he's done has been based on that, because that really is one of the things that makes him, that distinguishes him. And sometimes, you know, for many of us who are devotees, we would grow tired of how much energy he'd often put out in public talks to help people who weren't devotees. We just wanted him to be more with us. And over the years, he sort of divided his time a little bit between the two realities. But then he traces through, even just so that anybody reading this book can just at least hear what those basic principles are. When we went through Hope for a Better World, where Swamiji took on all of those thinkers, it's like Hope for the Better World was the next volume of Crises in Modern Thought. And most of us are so into this world that we don't remember anymore how many people are struggling with that one. But Swamiji is sowing seeds for the ages. I was in we attend the meetings, which are very small, informal gatherings of the Palo Alto Ministers Association, just to kind of keep in touch with a greater world than this one, because we are so self-enclosed here. And the last meeting we attended, the subject matter was young people. And a specific issue was the rise in suicide among high school people. Apparently, two Palo Alto high school boys committed suicide either in the last year or the last 2 years. You know, just really tough. And one boy in one of the Jewish congregations, you know, killed himself. Just terrible. You know, 13, 14-year-old kids. So there was this whole discussion of from psychologists and clergy people at this minister's meeting about this whole phenomenon, and everybody's has all these ideas about how what we should do and how we should deal with it, but very few people have stood far enough back from it the way Swamiji has to really understand why these children have such a sense of despair. And it has to do with things like what he's answering in Crises in Modern Thought. There's just this all-pervasive idea that has been foisted upon us by these so-called thinkers that there's no purpose in what we're doing. That what is the point? You know, just to grow up and have a good job and get rich and live like my parents just doesn't really, like, inspire young people very much. And in a perverse sort of way, I think we've added to it by talking to them so much about the nearly insoluble ecological and social and political problems. I mean, has it been such a good idea to get them so worried about the planet? And on one hand, we think it's going to make them responsible, but on the other hand, you know, the children say things like, you know, it's up to me to save the planet. I can't save a planet. And they begin to get quite nervous about it. And a lot of what you see in the really incomprehensible behavior of young people is because of this, because faith has just completely been taken away from them, and we're watching the consequences of our own actions, and we don't recognize it as such. And Ananda and the teachings of self-realization and Out of the Labyrinth for people who want to believe but can't, and Hope for a Better World, and God is for Everyone, these are really fundamental revolutionary contributions to reversing this trend. Swamiji was discussing some particularly unsavory aspect of culture that he's been trying to resist. And he says, you know, he said, I'm trying to save this culture. I'm not trying to pull it down. Just a simple comment. I'm trying to save this culture. And it's just interesting to sort of think on that level. Well, Master was the avatar for Dwapara Yuga, and Swamiji has been his primary spokesman, so it's not a presumptuous comment. It's not based on himself, it's based on what Master wants him to do. And crises in modern thought and the power that Swami, the importance that Swami's put into it and the way it came into Swami's life and how like it became the cornerstone of turning his energy back, was Master really saying, I want you to go into the world and bring them this message of hope. That's why I say it's the foundation of everything that he's done. Master's instruction to him, even before he was put out on his own, was I want you to go where people are suffering and bring them this message. It wasn't you can stay in India and just be a hermit or anything like that. It was no, this is where you have to go. And this is the interesting balance point that Ananda's always been walking, which is on one hand, we're self-realizationists wanting to withdraw into a supportive atmosphere, but on the other hand, we're soldiers making a beachhead for a revolution, and therefore we have to be on the beach. We can't just sort of stay in the boat. We have to get all the way in there, and that's the example Swami's just setting with this. Well, let's take a couple of minutes break. Pardon me? Yes, I wasn't going to talk more about that, though, but I said the reason it's all so vivid in my mind is I've been working on it. But I had something else to say that I don't... Well, it was in the middle of something and I said, wait, let's just start the camera. Can anyone remember? What were we talking about? Well, even though he was understated, he wasn't understated in himself at all. He wasn't even slightly understated in himself. He was very, very attuned to what was going on. And he was very conscious of the magnetism of things. It's just, he's always worked with magnetism. He's developed magnetism in people, and he's done everything to develop magnetism. I was just sort of looking at what the chapters here, I Write Music is one of these chapters, this whole cycle of his life that started with music. All of these things are so integral to the story of Ananda, and that's why he put that chapter in, not merely that he's telling the history of his life, I Write Music, because one of the reasons Ananda is successful is because of the music, because we all sing the same music. And you can go anywhere around the world and we're all singing the same music. And he's finding that the people in India are just loving this music. And this is, and it means a lot to him because he knows that the music is what holds Ananda together. It helps, it keeps us harmonious and it makes us unified in our consciousness no matter where we are. Much more, Kriya, of course, but the music also. Because it's an actual direct experience of consciousness that we're sharing continuously. And people who don't speak the same language yet know the songs. Or they'll even if you're singing in a different language, you know the melody and you know what it's about. In India, they, in the last 10 years, when Swami was there in the 50s, they just didn't hear Western music and they couldn't understand Western music. The Indian style of singing is so different. And they don't have harmony. It's just different. He said harmony to them is to sing an octave. They just didn't understand chords. But in the intervening decades, especially in the last 10 years or so, just Western music has completely invaded India. So they're just very accustomed to Western music, except they hear horrible Western music. But they know how to hear it. So now they're hearing... It's just so magnificent to think about what it would be like to just be hearing these songs for the first time. The words, the melodies, the vibrations of them. But what Master gave Swamiji or awakened him to the potential of all this music was just another sort of piece of the puzzle. Dive into this understanding of what is afflicting modern society so you can reach the world with my message. That's what Master was saying to him. I have an answer to what is afflicting them. And I want you, and Swami says all of 1964 he spent researching the book and how he had to discipline himself to read those preposterous teachings with an open mind and not a dismissive mind and not write about them rudely but write about them with enough respect so that he could really give an argument to somebody else. And then Master gave him this music, this whole new way. And Swamiji is he's very cautious about these things. He actually, he remarked that Master also wrote popular music. Like he used to sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, remember, and he changed a few words, and he put words to that classical piece. Remind me, Joe, the one.
It's Divine Love Sorrows.
Divine Love Sorrows. Yes. And can you just do a verse, just a line of it? That beautiful song? Yeah. That was the melody, was a well-known classical piece, and Master wrote words for it. And there was one other song, it seems to me, that Master... Yes, right, exactly. And so Swamiji said, well, Master did this too. Master wrote popular kinds of music. And Swamiji felt, well, if Master did it, then it's something that I can also do. Master, of course, didn't do it on the scale that Swami did. It's not that everything that Swami does, Master had to have done, but it did reassure him to sort of see that it was there. And now it's played this enormous role, not the least of which is it's given so many other people an opportunity to be artistic in a way that is right, it has a very strong vibration. You know, whereas if we just had to create our own songs, we wouldn't necessarily have had the inward power to create them at such a level. And so Ananda's a lot. And in the early years of Ananda, these are so much fun. Swamiji was, he wrote the harmonies and he started getting groups singing. And for many years, Swami did not sing solos at all. And he always had the groups sing. And it wasn't until the groups were well established that he went back to singing himself, because he wanted other people to get into it. And he knew that if he didn't give them that opportunity, they never would. He would just always pull himself back in order to make it happen for others. And you wouldn't even know that he was doing it. You would just sort of, that would be the way things were. And it would be only a long time later that you'd begin to realize again that he just wanted others to have the opportunity and wanted their commitment. But there were these quartets, mostly, or six or eight people singing, and they would sing these songs at Sunday service, in the little Sunday services that we had up there at Ananda Village. And many, many times, Joe, I don't know if you were ever in there, or if that was before your time, he would stop them in the middle of a song, correct them, or afterwards he would point out how they hadn't done it right. Oh, and people would get so upset. Oh, how dare he embarrass them, you know. And he just was persistent in it because he wanted them to put out the energy to really get it right. He wasn't going to be content with their just, as he said himself, every single note was deliberate. And I wasn't going to just let them just choose other notes because those notes were not right. It was a language and had to be said exactly right. Plus, there was like a... just not enough energy, not enough awareness. And he just kept correcting them and correcting them and correcting them until they began to put out enough energy to begin to get it right. I mean, he still does it sometimes. I don't know whether he... I can't remember whether it was in public or not. Go ahead. I was talking about... switch subjects here, but talking about when we were at the... when Ananda went to the SRF convocation to protest the lawsuit... and we were singing, a lot of SRF members, we sat on one particular day when the SRF members went on a field trip to all the other locations. The convocation is in a downtown hotel, and then they took a field trip to the various centers, Mount Washington and Hollywood Church. And we weren't on their property, we were right at their property. And at Mount Washington especially, it was very quiet. I wasn't with that group, but Christy and... I can't remember, maybe it was Christy, but... anyway, they sat right on the edge, and because it was very quiet there, they could be heard all over the grounds, and many SRF members thought that it was just a wonderful new addition to the field trips, was that there were these people singing Master's chants, you know, just like angels just around out there. And the other wonderful story from singing was the group went to the Hollywood Church, and they were just right there on the sidewalk. You know, we had found out what we could do legally, and so we had our place on the sidewalk. And all afternoon, they stayed there for hours, and these different buses would come, and they were right at the entrance, and so the people had to walk right past them. We were, you know, inches from the people we were trying to communicate with. And they would come, and they would have their little thing, and then we would sing, and then they would get on their bus, and they would go away, and there would be interludes. And, you know, as the day went on, things got looser and looser. And SRF had been so nervous about our coming that they had actually hired a security service. And so there were security guards, and they had been told, the security guards had just been prepared for God knows what. And so there was this sort of, at first they were so tough with us, and then there was this gradual realization that, you know, like, this is not what we expected. And especially at that Hollywood church that day, the security man was so enjoying what we were doing. He sort of, you know, would start saying, you know, "Here comes the bus." And once, like toward the end of the day, they were just a little worn out, and the bus was coming, and people were kind of lackadaisical, and he said, they're here, and start singing, you know, like this. He was just making it happen for us. It was just wonderful, because the music is, how can you doubt the goodness and sincerity of people who sing like that? And of course, we sing beautifully. You know, it was just, it was really, and all of that was, and that was why we were so joyful doing that. Swamiji had been a little nervous about our doing that because he was afraid we would become angry. And all of his concern about it was afraid. And for some reason, just because I guess I'm dumb, I always knew we wouldn't become angry. I just knew that we wouldn't. And so I was sort of, you know, a little impatient with him because he was always, you know, not wanting us to do it. And it went on, it took months, maybe even a year or so before we let it get started. He canceled the ideas several times. And then when we were there and we started going, and we had this idea that our whole presentation would be to sing, and the day or two into it, I said, "Oh, sir, everybody is just feeling so joyful." And he just wrote back, "I am so happy to hear that you are feeling so joyful." And that's what he kept talking the whole time. "I'm just so pleased that you're feeling joyful." In other words, that you're not fighting against anything, you're just fighting for. But how could you not feel joyful? We were just there, hours and hours chanting and singing Swami's songs. It was just heaven. And Master was patting us on the shoulder, chuckling with us. Now, that was an interlude, and I was doing something else. Does anyone else remember what I was doing?
Brenda asked a question that you were going to answer part two.
Oh, but yeah, there you have it. My brain is very free-form tonight. It just sort of goes here, and then it, like, forgets why it was there. Sometimes I can hold it together. I'm not sure.
You said that he was understated, or his point of view was...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess I've said that a number of times. But there you have it. You know... Once in one of the depositions, Swamiji was asked, "What is the role of the spiritual director?" His answer was classic. He said, "To protect the individual from the institution." Isn't that an answer for the head of the institution? But that's what he learned lying on his bed in his parents' house. You know, that there's somebody who has to always be remembering what we're really here for. And that is the job of the spiritual directors, to make sure that nothing ever is more important than the spiritual development of people. You see, these are absolutely essential things to understand, because Swami is already virtually out of the picture, and you all are still enjoying the presence of people such as myself who had some experience with him. But you're the voice. You're the instrument. It's your job. You have to remember and to do it correctly, and really just drawing these lessons deeply in. So the work that we've done here in all these years to develop what's happening here, it hasn't been difficult, because we've just done exactly what Swami did. We have never confronted a single circumstance in which we couldn't think back as to how he handled it. I mean, not necessarily exactly. And the principles are just so simple. People first. Where there is Dharma, there is victory. Nothing is more important than the realization, and the institution only exists for the spreading of the inspiration. And if you're not inspiring people, you're not doing it. What difference does it make? Nothing is happening. You have nothing. So our Master, even Master was, you know, seeing these big edifices. Divine Mother says, "Do you want this? Is this what you want? Or do you want just to be by the Ganges and feeling God's presence? That's all that matters. We do this." So, let's see, is there anything else? I think that may just sort of cover about where we are. So anyway, we brought Swamiji finally to the end, where he had just one other point that I thought was really interesting. when he just had that little paragraph, he said, fortunately, my no is never absolute. He said, I'll stand back and think about it. And then it'll change to well, maybe. And then he talked about how Dhyamata didn't always understand. That sometimes he would say no, and then actually he would act differently than his first response. And other people would say yes and never put any energy behind it. And that's where, again, he said, I learned at Ananda that I don't listen to what people say, I listen to what they do. I watch what they do and see how what their behavior actually is, not how they verbalize their thoughts. Because sometimes we just have things that we say. Because he got himself in so much trouble with Daya by saying things to her that were not really representative of his nature. And she then went on his words and failed to observe his actions. So he just made every mistake there was. Between him and them, they made all the mistakes there were, and he just made very, very, very careful note of these and then established a reality that was different. And in the end of this book, he really sums this up more, that it was much more than personal, that this was the great karmic, that's the last chapter of this book, karmic patterns, this great cosmic battle that's going on between the inevitable pull of Maya to institutionalize and ruin the message of the masters, and that master's work is in that battle, and that this whole thing between Swamiji and SRF has really been that cosmic battle. They've just been instruments of the two sides, and that Ananda is the alternative, the attempt to pull master's work into Dwapara Yuga instead of having it eaten like Christianity was. Right back, oh, I know what I was going to say, now I remember. I read in a book, and I don't know what the source of this was, but this was a story. This is the question that Brenda asked about whether SRF would ever sing Ananda music. And I said, well, someday, when it's all over. This was a story. There was a tremendous amount of... This is about early Christianity, and that's why I don't know what the basis of this story is, but it's apocryphal, if not true. And I think it is also true. At least it's the legend. There was a tremendous antagonism between Peter and Paul, because Peter played the role that Swami plays, essentially, and Paul played the role that Dhyamata plays. Between the Jerusalem... I said it backwards. Paul is Swamiji, although some psychic said that Swamiji actually was Paul. Swami's answer was twofold. First, he said, I would like to think that Paul is self-realized by now. Was his first remark. And his second was, I've never liked that guy very much. And I don't think he was, in the sense that the personality of Paul is not like Swamiji's. You know, Swami's energy is lighter and just more creative and just different than that. But the role they played is remarkably similar, which is very interesting. But what Paul did was, Paul was determined. I mean, he didn't even know Christ. He had the vision of Christ. He was a persecutor of the Christians. And then he was on his way to persecute Christians somewhere, and he was struck with the vision of Jesus and was struck blind. And in the vision, Jesus said, why are you persecuting me? And Paul was converted and took that same zeal and became a proselytizer for Jesus. And he had this zeal that this was a message that needed to be carried everywhere. And he was just determined to do it, and he gave his life to do it. He was an extraordinary character in that respect. And he just was persecuted and beaten and stoned and jailed, and he never gave up, and finally had his head chopped off. And at the same time that he was doing all of that, he was innovating. He was the one who created Christianity. Christianity, there was no Christianity. There was only Judaism when Jesus died. This was a sect of Judaism. It never stopped being Jewish. That's what I try to tell Jews who are uncomfortable with this. I said, look, Jesus never stopped. It never stopped being Judaism. It's Paul that you should be upset with, not Jesus. But Paul, he went around and he tried to convert Jews to this new expression of Judaism. But the Jews wouldn't have any part of it because the priests were corrupt, really. The priests had a lot of power and money, and they were corrupt. And so that's why when I tell the story, I always say that the priests did it to Jesus instead of the Jews, because it's just more politically correct and also more true. Because the Jews were also his followers, so the Jews were on both sides of the question. But he could not get the establishment of Judaism to accept it, so he started looking for people who would accept it, and so he carried it out to the Gentiles. And then he just started adapting it so it would fit the consciousness and the vibrations and the cultures of the Gentiles. And the Jerusalem Christian Jews just thought this was blasphemous because the Jews were so separate from all of these others. There was just no mixing of them. And Jesus had been a rabbi who taught them this. And I've often commented, you find Paul writing these intense letters examining in enormous theological detail about whether or not you can be saved if you're not circumcised. And you read it now and you think, this is a very strange discussion. But it wasn't strange at the time because the discussion was whether or not the message of Jesus applied to non-Jews. And if you became a Christian, did you have to convert to Judaism in order to benefit from the teachings of Jesus, or was this a new dispensation? Was this a new reality? So Paul's going around doing this tremendous work, and the Jerusalem Jews are mostly just hovering there. They've been ostracized by their own community, and they're literally starving. But the effort they put out is they send missionaries out to go where Paul has gone and to tell those people that what Paul taught them was wrong. You know, it's just like, it was unbelievable. And what and all these, you know, we only have fragments of it, but it was just this constant, unbelievable conflict where the Jerusalem Jews, led by Peter, could not understand what Paul was doing, and then Paul tried to win Peter. Finally, what happened, interestingly, is that they were really literally starving to death, and Paul collected a huge amount of money and brought it to them and just saved their lives. And then it was much more difficult for them to be against what he was doing. But at different times, Paul tried to get Peter, and Peter waffled. The way the story is told, it's so similar. Peter would be persuaded by Paul that what he was doing was right, and then the other group of Jerusalem Jews would tell Peter that he'd made a mistake, and then Peter would retract his approval of Paul, and it just went back and forth. And ultimately, there was so much conflict between Peter and Paul that some say that it was Peter's followers who engineered Paul's execution. You know, because they felt that he was a threat to the future of the Christianity because of what he was doing. Now, as time passed, the whole story was just to get to here. As time passed, the followers of Peter, either the generations after or the same ones, were so ashamed of what they had done because they began to see what the reality of this was, that there was this enormous effort by the followers of Peter to reconcile with the followers of Paul. And it's an interesting little sort of footnote to history because it took that for them to see it. So who's to say? Yeah. Well, you know, I'll just speculate here. I guess I'll speculate on tape. Master told Swamiji that death would be the final sacrifice. They said, you will find God at the end of your life, but don't think about it. Death will be the final sacrifice. And Swami sometimes says, you know, death is no sacrifice. So you wonder, will he die a martyr's death of some kind? You know, will, and at different times, you know, people have become alarmed for his well-being. At certain times, the antagonism has been so great, we've commissioned some of the bigger men, you know, in a quiet way to watch the crowds. You know, will some nut, thinking he's doing the right thing, take Swami's life, just like Peter's disciple supposedly engineered Paul's demise? Who's to say? But would such an outrageous action actually result in reconciliation? Because it would just bring the thing to such a point that maybe then people would see that this is not the way for devotees to behave? Who could say? It just sort of, you know, it just hovers out there and you wonder, because we'll probably all of us, perhaps not every one of us, but probably all of us will live to the end of the story, so we'll know. Very interesting. But we must always hold the thought. Swamiji wrote a last will, and even he has very little physical to dispense with, so there was almost nothing in it. But he wrote in his will, I want it understood that if there is ever the opportunity to reconcile with SRF with integrity, I want it known that that's what I want to have happen. I do not want, out of zealous, false loyalty to me and what happened to me, that you should carry on this antagonism. I want it understood. Let there be no mistake about it. And he said it very emphatically. It was very moving. So we have that in front of us. So, okay. That's it. A couple of more classes. We read 4 more, 5 more tomorrow. Where do we go? We read about New Age movements. We read all the way through domes and self-expansion.